This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Welcome back, listeners, to Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 447. We are barreling down to staring down 450 looming on the horizon. What will it be? What can we do? I'm proud to say we were able to lure Super Steve from the bunker back. Say hi, Super Steve.
Hi, Super Steve. It's not that hard. Was it really that hard to get me to come back? I've had time to read books. I've been reading.
That's good.
Kevin and I are also here manning the gates, and we're seeing if communication can be reestablished to the Ottawa Otter. He is currently on a super secret mission. But if he returns in time, we'll patch him through to get the latest updates.
Indie. I sent him on a mission to go find an indie, all the indie issue 450s. And don't come back until he's found a few.
That might take a while.
I thought you were going to send him out for toilet paper. Some may argue a subtle difference.
Wow.
Indie Comic Book Noise is part of the Deliberate Noise Network. Thanks to Derek, as always, head of the Deliberate Noise Network. In addition to wherever you found this audio file, you can find old episodes on our webpage. Our webpage is indiecomicbooknoise.com. We also have a Facebook page.
Purportedly.
And we have Twitter handles for the podcast. It's its own entity. So feel free to follow along at indiecomicbookn. And you can get sassed by a sentient bot.
Lots of sass.
Hey, speaking of Derek Howard, I got my physical copy of the Mike Grell Maggie the Cat Kickstarter the other day. And you know, it's got like the acknowledgments of the people who pledge. And whenever it's something that I know that there's going to be a few of my friends who I'll recognize, I take the time to, you know, like when it's the Ditko ones or, and so with the Grell one, I was like, oh, let's see. And don't you know, in the, I guess it's on the second page, but in the first column, Derek Howard's on there twice.
Oh,
wow.
My name should be in there somewhere, Steve.
Yeah, it is. Yep, you're there.
I just got the boring stuff. No exciting commissions or anything. So I got mine pretty early on. It was all you people, all you big spenders getting your fulfillments late. Indie Comic Book Noise also is sort of a free form chit chat among buddies talking about anything that does not have to do exclusively with intellectual property owned by Disney or Warner Ooh. Brothers.
Wow, that's limiting it, isn't it?
Exactly.
Wow.
Well, I think the dream for a lot of the creators we discuss is to have their products purchased in Bob.
This is supposed to be the forum for us to not be limited due to our usual restrictions over on Marvel Noise when we wanted to talk about other books besides Marvel.
And as
this would be non-Big Two Noise.
Yes. Well, as Steve hinted, you can also hear some of us over on our sister show, Marvel Noise. The big differentiation, other than the content itself, is the fact that you will not hear that warning you heard at the beginning of this episode. And we keep that one strictly family friendly. Although I would recommend that your family be into Marvel Comics, or they might find it somewhat not interesting.
Yep, and have discussions with college level vocabulary.
Because unless kids really like comics, it's not probably going to be for them all the time.
You have to either really like comics or really like Kevin, one or the other.
Whoa.
Well, probably if you like one, you like the other. I'm not going to say which comes first, though. All right, boys, here we are. Who wants to, as is tradition, someone brings up a topic they want to discuss, and we contribute as is necessary. /wanted/however we feel like.
And sadly, no more con men.
So what you been reading?
Damn.
What do you got in your pile? I used to love, like, going to, our routine was, you know, in the summertime, on the weekends, was to walk to Fanico, which was our LCS at the time, that was downtown. And we were more in, like, the first edge of, like, the suburbs outside of the city proper of Albany. And we could walk through a few different, like, SUNY-owned, like, college-owned properties, and the city park, Washington Park, and cross through that, and then cross through a few streets and have a path to get to the comic book store. So on the way back, when we go through the park, we would find a nice big tree to either climb up in and, you know, open up our bags and start reading our comics out of there, or sit at the base of and just sit around at the, you know, sit on the grass in a big park and do that look over to your friend and be like, what'd you get? You know, what do you what's in your brown paper bag there? This is before they had the personalized stamped plastic bags from each comic shop, you know, and you just get your brown paper bag, like, hey, what'd you get in yours? Oh, I got this, and, oh man, what's in your pile, you know?
Yeah, I never experienced the brown paper bag scenario. That sounds suspicious.
Hey, once in a while, you go to a shop that's out of those plastic bags, and they slide it across in a brown paper bag like you're buying some dirty magazine or something.
Yeah, you never know when it's going to be an Omaha the Cat Dancer in there.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. No, I like all the personalized bags. You get to see all these cool, like, sometimes they got, like, all these different artists or whatever to do their own, up their own designs on their bags. So it's kind of nice.
I usually end up at some place that's giving out the free comic book day bag from 4 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I still have some of those bags.
Well, I think I threatened this book many, many episodes ago, so I might as well bust it out from the Ideas Workshop, IDW. I tried one of their side spinoff ROM books, ROM Dire Wraiths. Or is it Wraiths? Which one?
Wraith?
Wraith or Wrath? I like Wrath, but it's Wraith, probably.
That's exactly how I felt, Andrew. We are brothers from another mother. I always read it as Wrath because of their hostile nature, but they were Wraiths. Let's face it.
Chris Rial, Luca Pizzari, Jim Boswell, and I have issue one, One Small Step for a Dire Wraith Kind. Now, what's interesting about the Dire Wraiths, many of you likely already know this if you're listening to some obscure comic book podcast, but for those that don't, ROM was originally a very unimpressive toy. Its main claim to fame was existing. It had patents for its sound and lights feature. Patents which, I believe, about 10 years ago have finally expired. And it was a very unimpressive toy that didn't live long on the shelves. But as was the custom, they needed to promote it. And if you didn't have the money for a TV show, you get a comic book company to come and sort of build IP around your toy and make it so the kids want it. And they chose Marvel Comics, who came up with the ROM comic book. Now, as a kid, I loved the ROM comic book. I don't think I ever saw the toy. I saw commercials, but that thing came and went, I feel like, in a hot minute. Like, I don't even think they had a second wave of the toy. Steve, did you ever see the toy? Like, back in the day?
Yeah. Yes, and it was terrible, and the skinny little arms, and it, poor articulation, poor proportions, and there was never any follow-up accessory toy of any kind, or any other wave, or any other character, or anything. It was all Marvel that really did it. I know we're indie noise here, but Marvel and DC... Marvel, maybe to more of an extent, must have solicited themselves to various toy companies and stuff, because at the time they were like in the market for that. Like, there was a few different toys that they were doing as comic books, and DC to a lesser extent with like Atari Force and things like that, but they also had their IP. I mean, Marvel did everything from Crystar the Crystal Warrior to Shogun Warriors.
To Godzilla, like any kind of adaptation. Obviously, most famously, probably Star Wars, I would say. But ROM, and as Steve noted, ROM, so Marvel created a ton of the surrounding IP that fans of ROM grew to know as ROM. So ROM basically was the static toy, the Galadorian Space Knight, and I don't even know if that part of it might have been Marvel. And he had a couple of little gee-gaws in his hand, like a translator and a light blast. And contrasting with the toy, that's about it. So they had to create bad guys, love interests, other knights, all that stuff. So when the license came up a couple years ago, the people behind IDW were fans of it, of ROM. They were able to get the license, but they got originally the license to just ROM. So for most of us that were fans, a lot of the related Marvel IP that went with it was kind of what we were digging. So it was weird to see a reboot of ROM that's just, hey, it's just the toy type of thing. Kind of like when Wizard of Oz came out of public domain maybe 20 years ago, but you couldn't base it on the movie. You could only base it on the book. And there were like 900 comic book adaptations, but they had to avoid the stuff from the movie and land it on the book. But the Dire Wraiths have now been secured by IDW, so they can introduce ROM's most classic villain. And what was appropriately for the Marvel was, in those days, they were sort of magic using beings, and they could change shape, and ROM would have his little device and he could send them into Limbo. I think it was called Limbo or whatever their other dimension was.
Right.
Which seemed perfect for a cartoon, because in the cartoons you can't kill your bad guys. So I have to think at some point there were some storyboards out there in the world for a ROM cartoon if the toy line had taken off. I'm almost sure. But here we have the Dire Wraiths in their own spin-off book. Yes, Steve, you were going to say something.
So what I'm dying to know is, are they sorcery-based? Are they identity stealers? Because I don't think it was that they were I could be wrong, but I don't think it was that they were shapeshifters. I think that they could assume identities, so it was always like a persona that they were taking on. It wasn't like they could shift into, you know, shape of
right, but they could look human, I guess. You are correct. I overstated it. Their power set allowed them to assume a human form.
Yeah, so they would do someone sympathetic, right? Like a kid or a priest or something, and then ROM comes along and turns them into dust. People think he's just killed a priest, but really he didn't even kill a Dire Wraith. He just sent them to Limbo, which they might as well be dead.
And like any good property, as the series developed, I liked that they got away. Well, I liked having them as a background villain. I was never interested in those properties where it's just always two against each other. Like G.I. Joe was always fighting Cobra and Transformers and Decepticons. I liked it. ROM was able to be integrated, so every week, some weeks, he would get to fight a different villain, which I like. But that being said, I do want to see, for me, I started the IDW ROM book, which was fine, read a couple issues, but it just didn't resonate. I think I'm lacking all those, so I was excited to tuck right in, and I have to say, it's a, you know, strong, well-conceived artwork for this opening one, and it starts with the Wraiths having a base on our moon. So a lot of the interesting thing is, how are they going to integrate themselves into the United States? Because that was a big thing when ROM gets to Earth in the Marvel book. They had already pre-arrived, so they already have agents in place and everything, and that made it a little bit harder. But again, we have their traditional rivals. So, and because ROM is a group of has buddies, other space knights, they can have those other space knights die, and it raises the stakes. Where if it's just ROM, clearly they're not going to kill the title toy in the first, you know, it adds stakes, I felt. And in this world, they decided to have a multinational secret base that handles aliens, sort of a X-Files team, and they're placing it at the time of Earth doing moon landings and all that. But those people are unaware of this multinational Black Ops Shield group that are designed to handle extraterrestrial threats. And in the interim, the Wraiths are also the threat that they're mainly going to have to face off on. So we see, and the Wraiths are more than capable of taking out the humans. Which, you know, we knew. Like, we don't have fancy armor and all that stuff. And so this first one is setting all that up. But you do get to see some ROM action. And he's classic, you know, the kind of weird barrel chest. Square, but it's a square barrel. Yeah, I liked it. I thought the beginning one was maybe a little wordy, I thought. Seemed a little stiff, late introduction. Kevin, did you get this one too, or no?
I didn't. I think I asked you about it, but then we sort of forgot about what we were doing.
Do the Wraiths have the, like, prehistoric bird-like energy creatures that they used to throw around?
And this one, they're kind of like lizardy creatures, but with lots of tentacles. Think Cthulhu almost. Huh. So sometimes they have wings, or and so the tentacles can kind of envelop you. And,
oh boy.
And they also have a bit of an insectoid at times. You know, multiple eyes and that kind of thing to make them scary looking as they infiltrate this the squad. And you see them, they have captured a space knight.
Uh-oh.
And they're doing him in, and it's a nasty scene. And that helps set the stage of, like, you know, it's this ongoing war between these two groups.
So it's not a Battlestar Galactica thing.
I'm not that... I haven't read those comics in forever. Although I did... Okay. Honestly, I did look at buying a lot of them on eBay. But I said, Andy, walk away. Walk away. Because there's not that many. Like, the run was pretty contained. It was something about 40 or 50 issues or something. And I have fond memories of the book. I just don't. I was like, oh, that's not on Marvel Unlimited. Maybe I'll just buy a big brick of Battlestar Galactica. But anyways, I'm getting away from... This is ROM Dire Wraiths, issue 1. While people are listening to this to no doubt escape, I will admit, I kind of haven't been buying comics recently, new comics, so don't have number 2. Unsure if it came out or how the distribution is working, but I bought this one a while ago, so I would think number 2 might have come out yet. Because it should have come kind of, it should be out, maybe 3 even.
I read a number 1 also. I almost said I read a number 1 too, but you know how confusing that sounds. But it's from Dark Horse, and it's Mike Allred's new book, X-Ray Robot number 1.
Oh, yeah. Hey. There was a preview at the end of Bang for X-Ray Robot.
It's written and drawn by Mike Allred, with Laura Allred doing her color work that is so complimentary to Mike's stuff that he does. And in January of this year, in 2020, there was a Kickstarter by a fellow, Christopher Irving, who I've done a few Kickstarters, supported a few of his Kickstarters in the past. He does cool card packs and like trading card. I think he did a Jeffrey Brown Incredible Change Bots card pack, and he did something else that was Allred related, and he did a Madman verse backstage pass fun kit that was a set of trading cards that also included a X-Ray Robot card. And one of the stretch goals ended up being a really sweet embroidered X-Ray Robot head patch. So I was a little bit excited already before the issue even hit the stands. And like you said, there was the preview over in Matt Kent's book. And it's a fun book. The first issue came out. The basic gist is that Professor Max Wilding is working in a self-proclaimed robotics lab on the verge of interdimensional travel.
and he dons this suit of sensors with the helmet, and it holds on to these little handheld controls, and he's able to remotely pilot this large, cool-looking, retro, all-redesigned robot. And he sends it through a dimensional barrier successfully. But the professor, Wilding, he sees like experiencing some weird after effects. He's having some visions and being a little distant and off. He's changed from the experience. And he, as a scientist, of course, he wants to learn more. And the next voyage is more like a trip, like a psychedelic trip. The robot is merging with him and then melting off of him, and there's floating brains and flights over kaleidoscopic landscapes. It's really all red, wild, fun stuff. But when the dust clears, there's Max Wilding still, and then there's also Max Wilding from the future, presumably talking from the robot with a little visible brain compartment on top of the head of the robot now. So there's some kind of something happened, and we're going to find out more next issue. There's plenty of other like nuances and layers to the characters and their interactions with each other and relationships and stuff, but I'm just giving you the basic gist. But it's a very clean looking book, of course, and very fun. I mean, I really didn't know what to expect other than a purple retro robot design that I had seen, and it's a good narrative, and it gives that opportunity for Allred to do the interdimensional stuff. Very cool.
For a second, I got confused because I picked up the Oming's new creator-owned thing. I'm like, oh, wait, no, he said Allred, not Oming.
I said salsa, not salsa.
You know why people like salsa? It's going to be our new bit.
Let's be honest. Why?
It was supposed to be the summer of George.
Well, I know Kevin and I teamed up on something. I was reading, I got a bunch of books out of the library before everything happened, and so now I'm stuck with them. But I picked up, one of them was Hope Nicholson's The Spectacular Sisterhood of Superwomen, which are female characters from comic book history. And they're just, it's divided by eras, and they're just random. So I was reading about the, you know, gold and silver age. And she was like, oh, there's this web Canadian archive website thing that has comics. So I checked out the link, and it didn't work for me, but I sent it to Kevin because he's a computer guy. And he was able to find one.
And a Canadian.
So we were able to find a Golden Age Canadian comic book. Which
Fun. It's so weird. Like, the government of Canada has a library and archives Canada website for a few comic books. And apparently there's more at their physical location, too, which would be kind of cool to visit.
Yeah, I'll put...
I mean, you're trying to tell me that there were Canadian comics before Richard Comley's Captain Canuck?
Way before.
What I like is that... I'll put a link in the show notes, but... The site is pretty hard to navigate. So here they are. It's like they hide them behind something, but they scanned it in, and it scanned a copy. Like, you know those old comics someone wrote on the cover and all that sort of stuff? So it has all those physical artifacts of the book being in. It's not like they found, you know, the old plates or whatever, but Kevin and I selected Dime Comics number 1.
Dime Comics. It seems... It seems like something like if IDW, like, you know, that Yo's Comics, like this is how you would get the comic anyways.
Yes.
Dimebag Comics, number 1.
But it's from 1942, February in specific. So we're going to get right into the, you know, war stuff, obviously. But,
wow.
Yeah, if you had one thin Canadian dime back then, Steve, that would have been like, you know, nothing American back in the 40s.
I have no idea even how that would joke would work.
But we start our first, it's three tales told. And surprisingly, what shocked me the most, I think, Kevin, was there wasn't that much advertising. I thought there would have been more, but maybe because it's a number one, they couldn't secure. I mean, there is some that we'll talk about, but I kind of expected more advertising. But then I don't read a lot of Golden Age books, so maybe that was more an artifact of the Silver and Bronze Ages.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like regular ads, right? And then they have stuff like how to draw, and like it seems pretty regular. Like there's nothing that sticks out as like you're like, what is going on here?
No, I just thought there would be more of that. You know, like I'm used to higher frequency, but maybe Canadian comics are classy. But our first tale,
I don't know,
is Rex Baxter in the Island of Doom by Edmund Good. And what I like the most is Mr. Good, kind of like the European artist, signs a panel on every page. Not every panel, but one panel on each page has a signature, which I always thought was so cool, like a interesting Euro artifact.
Yeah, way ahead of his time, too, right? Doing this in the early 40s?
Yeah, and he's smart, too. They were smart, I feel like, and Kevin can disagree, but I feel like his art is the strongest of the three stories we're going to see. Maybe not the most interesting story, but I think the art, they went with their strongest foot forward first.
I think that's fine, yeah. Also, I don't feel like you hit that wall of text, which is good.
Yeah, they're just like, hey, Rex Baxter, he's a swinging dick out having fun on the high seas. Bam, you're on a boat with some chick, and that's it.
I know. I mean, they do have some of the captions that are describing what's happening, but it's not like overly so.
No. And there's classic 40s, like on the second page, the caption box, love laughs at danger, and the gay couple find a moonlit deck more in tune with their thoughts. And so he's macking on this girl, and he spots a submarine ready for the kill. And Actung, torpedo fire.
You also have the references to the time. If you don't know, like he makes a reference to, oh no, we're going to get a ticket to Davy Jones' locker. And if you don't know what that means, you better look that up so you can figure out. But you sort of get it by context.
Well, she says, you mean they try?
Yeah.
So she's going to help us through this heavy nautical references. But anyways, exactly. They decide to jump off like right before. And then it's a nice half page splash. Another thing I don't associate with Golden Age comics are, you know, half page splashes. I like it. This isn't your 9-panel grid, Kevin.
Yeah, it's weird because I think some of those early Kirby comics, right, had the half page splash too.
Yes,
but I don't think I saw it a lot.
Yeah, it just felt kind of more modern than I. Again, this is just my ignorance. I don't read a ton of Golden Age, the storytelling and the racism and sexism and the other.
Well, things. Remember, right up through the 60s for both, and even into the 70s for both Marvel and DC and other major publishers, Charlton and Gold Key, Harvey, I think even Harvey, but they would sell half page ads to, you know, the comics were ad based. It wasn't, you weren't building IP for, you know, other media outlets at that time. So it was all about the ad revenue. So they stuck as many, you know, inside front cover, back cover. The ads were all through the comic. The gatefold of, you could do a double page ad in the middle for, you know, selling grit or whatever. And they had half page ads. So I think that may be where the half page splash kind of came into use.
Well, I tell you, I don't mind it because it almost allowed a Ditko Hawk and Dove page to find its way to me. I got outbid, but the fact, because it's only a half page of original art, because obviously the ad isn't, you know, that was, it's just blank. They put the ad in after. It made the price almost reasonable. So I don't mind some of those old timey when they just okay, just draw half a page. They must have liked it too. But my point is, it's a nice, like, the ship blowing up is nice, and them jumping to danger, and the Nazis celebrating and everything.
It's funny that we're reading these Golden Age comics, because I remember in previous episodes you hating on some Golden Age. You're like, oh, those Golden Age comics, man.
Yeah, well,
and here we are.
Like I said, there's some of the racist and sexist stuff wears on me. But this is, you know, we can hate on Nazis, right? It's still cool. Like, they're still baggers. And then somehow, the part I like is this, the freight they were on that the man and woman were having a romantic moment on has a gun on it somehow.
Yeah.
And they blow the sub out. You know, like, most cruise lines or whatever just have a giant deck gun that can blow up the Nazis. But the whole point is, both boats get sunk. So the two of them are trapped at sea, and they find a piece of the wreckage.
Of course.
That lets them float. And unlike Titanic, there's room for both of them on this one.
And also, you don't have to sew all these dead bodies together for a raft either.
I was wondering if they were going to go there. I'll be honest with you, Kim. But what the other part I like is that he then has to fight a giant ray, a manta ray, because you know how they're notorious man-eaters.
Do a barrel roll, Fox.
You know, like those, you know, you guys have been to the kitty aquariums, right? Where they always have the rays are the ones that you reach in and get to pet.
Sure.
Well, apparently they're also, the ones that live in the ocean, Steve, are notorious man-eaters, and he had to kill one.
Also, the ones in outer space, you don't want to run into those.
Weasels ripped my flesh.
So they end up making it aboard to an island.
And, a lost island?
Yeah, Rex has to carry her. She passes out, but she makes it. And then they just, it's him showing that he's like a regular Boy Scout. He has this knife and can start a fire and build everything. And he's Robinson Crusoe. And then again, another, like some kind of monitor lizard is going to attack his girl. So he kills that one.
Well, there's that humming too, where they're kind of like eating and investigating, and then they kind of forget about. There's this weird humming coming from the island.
Yeah, and when I, like I said, it's weird that they decided to keep the creatures and everything real, like a ray and a monolith. Like, why not just have dinosaurs? Like, just let us
That's
have
what
fun.
I expect.
Like, don't
like you're thinking they're gonna go to Monster Island or something.
Yeah, like make it more. But then it ends that humming, a great roar, roaring crash, like the burst of doom, hurls tons of rocks in the air. And then some kind of bowling ball shoots out.
I know. And it says it came out of the earth. And what I love, it says this next month, out of the earth. They're not giving you any extra info here.
And it's a 3/4 splash for our exciting page with a little insert, so... Nuts to you. And then they have an ad for Dime Comics. Kev, do you still subscribe to their... Do you still get Dime Comics on your pull list?
You know, I actually looked up this address. Dime Comics is not there.
And then it's a cartoon, how to draw the Dime Comics way. Waiting for that. And then the second feature might be my favorite. Steve, I think you're going to like it. It's the title character, Johnny Canuck.
Yeah. Get him, Johnny.
And Johnny Canuck is a non-drug-addled Captain Canada fighting the Nazis. Except he can also be a pilot. And so it's just a super soldier beating up Nazis. But they find a way to make him shirtless most of the time, mercifully. Because I know a lot of people are like, you know, these guys are wearing shirts too often. And this one is full-on fantasy. He's in a fight with the Nazis and gets shot down in a prehistoric land. Again, excuses for everyone to take their shirts off so they can fight mono.
Everyone's been hitting the gym.
Yeah, the 40s, you don't think of that peak physical time, but these guys are well doing. And this is Leo Buckley, I believe, is the guy behind Johnny Canuck. But my favorite part is, so he ends up in this like primitive weird society with resources they need to plunder. So they're going to burn him at the stake, but because he lips off to the leader, he was like, yes, I'm going to give you a fate worse than getting burned to death. You're going to have to fight me in a duel. And I'm like, how is that work? Like, you know, I'd rather get cut to death than burned alive. But apparently, you know, obviously Johnny Canuck wins. And because he wins, he also now gets to become leader of the tribe. And I'm like, wait a second.
That was so weird. Like, their whole reasoning for some of these things, I'm like, I don't know how that works. Oh, I don't want to seem uncivilized, so I'll give you a slight chance that you can win.
This sounds like the plot to Black Panther.
So it went from guaranteed death to now you run the place. And I'm like, who wouldn't, every time, mouth off to the worst case, you're going to die either way. But this one is a little wordier, I felt, Kevin. A lot of, yeah, like, explaining the tribe and why. And so Johnny's going to go back to civilization and bring these resources. But, you know, they're going to make sure Johnny, you know, doesn't need a shirt most of the time. Or his shirt is very skin tight. Let's put it that way. And then he gets back to society and has to fight more Nazis. And then the Nazis lead him to scantily clad women. And that goes back to the tribe. And I do like the tanks that they end up fighting. And he ends up shooting through their little slots in the tank. And he can take a pistol and shoot the Nazis inside. And
well, that's the other thing. The one guy is so precise at shooting him, he shoots the gun out of his hand. But then when Johnny Canuck, like, leaps towards him point blank, he can't shoot him. And I'm like, come on.
Serpentine, Johnny, serpentine.
I like how the panel, like, it's not just straightforward, like, okay, this is going to divide up the page into, like, four panels. Like, there's one point where there's actually, like, a circular panel and everything. Like, they're varying the panel layout up.
Yeah. This reminded me very much of a lot of the books I read during the 80s black and white boom. Like, the kind of, the anatomy was very kind of goofy and the fight scenes are kind of weird. Like, the perspective's all off, but Johnny's got, like, a six-pack that is always in effect. Like, a few nice, like, poster-style pinups of him, like, looking good and taking on the tanks. And the tanks are kind of, like, the proportions are off. Like, the tanks look kind of small.
It's just funny that he takes on a tank. I'm like, he has, and it even mentions, oh, he only has this cheap gun, but he's going to take on a tank. And sure enough, he can take on a tank.
Yeah, he can shoot right through the slots and... And I like the scantily, he always has to run into the scantily clad woman for like two panels that's there in her revealing top and everything, but still keeping it, you know, within the 40s and everything. But I like how the tribe with their bow and arrows is going to take on the tank. Like, we don't think that's going to create problems, Kevin, but.
No. No, it's precision shooting, remember.
But yeah, Johnny, he's there, takes out the tank till his gun jams, and then he just jumps on top and pulls them out of the tank and bashes their heads together. He's like, yeah, a real Canadian. I thought he might
pull something inside the tank, but he's like, no, nothing that brutal.
So then when he gets he has to, you know, get captured, of course, so they can keep him shirtless.
Naturally.
And in front of the firing squad, the cowardly Germans are frightened by the British planes arriving. And Johnny just flexes his muscle and breaks the ropes.
Well, if you want to hold a Canadian captive, you need to have stronger rope. Not steep rope.
Johnny had them where he wanted them the whole time.
But yeah, if you like muscular dudes from the 40s, this is the book for you. And so Johnny decides how he's going to do it his old school. So he goes up to the top of the cliff and drops boulders on the tanks to crush them.
It's true. It's awesome.
And then he gets to meet Winston Churchill in the end. There's a panel of Winston Churchill and one of Hitler in London and Berlin. But next month, Johnny Canuck returns, only in Dime Comics. Now there's a character they should bring back. And his picture at the return is obviously shirtless too, in case you were worried that somehow. And then some, like, Ripley's Believe It or Not, but not Ripley's Believe It or Not. They had a few political cartoons about Mussolini that I didn't understand.
Mm.
I assume it's parodying very specific things in 1942 era. I mean, they call him El Duce, which I got that reference, but I didn't get the humor. You know, obviously there's particular news in the 40s, but I thought it was interesting to have political comics in a regular comic book. I thought that was cool.
You mean they stuck their politics into your comics?
No, Kevin, they only do that now. They didn't do that in 1942.
Okay.
And then it's Kenneth Scotty McDonald by L. Cooper. And this is a plane battle. And I think the planes are and ships and everything are well rendered. The figure work is a little stiff, but it's, again, you know, World War pilot story, flying these old, well, to then it would have been brand new planes, I guess. For us there, and I liked, like I said, the vehicle work I liked a little bit, but it was a little stiff for the characters in it. But it's mostly, you know, dog fights going after.
Yeah, fights. I don't find that as interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'm not as into dog fights.
Yeah. Well, I also think it's kind of pretty more straightforward. You know, we don't have weird tribes and everyone wears their shirt in this story.
Yeah. They even have, like, weird trench coats, like plaid. I guess that's a plaid trench coat?
It looked like he was in his bathrobe, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And then...
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like polka dots, and then the other guy has plaid.
Yeah. And so, you know, but anyways, you know, Scotty of the RAF. And obviously, for those of you unaware, Canada, you know, still a vassal of England back in the 40s. I think they only cast off their shackles in the last couple decades. Still saluting the Queen and all that business. And then it ends again with another Il Duce cartoon with him. Apparently, I guess he failed in Egypt. So it's his face on a bomb saying, "A dud." I didn't really laugh. I understood it vaguely, but it didn't. But again, like I said, Kevin, that's not politics in your comics. You only think that is. Okay.
All right.
And then an ad on the back page for WoW Comics and Dart Daring, the Master Swordsman. But yeah, like a war comic made in war for free. And like I said, I'll put our show notes. Hopefully it's still up. I don't know if Canadian internet is going to go down soon or what.
Oh. So we could, at some point we might get to Active Comics or Commando Comics.
Go Commando with Commando Comics.
Yeah, you'll have to send me those links again, Kevin. I lost all the links to everything.
Look at you.
Not good with computers.
All these bell features you lost.
All these guys, and I'm the guy editing this thing. But anyways, that was fun. Like I said, free, and it wasn't too bad. Like, obviously, they're making fun of the Nazis and stuff, but it wasn't too bad. Mercifully, they didn't have any black characters or anything in this thing, so it's not like you're, like, as disappointed as I can sometimes be. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I think the worst was, like, oh, look at these primitives or whatever.
But, I mean, come on. They couldn't stop Johnny Canuck, so weren't they kind of primitive? I'm not saying blame the victim here, but, you know.
I don't know. They had six packs like he did.
Everybody was muscly in that book.
And then he talks about someone that taught him how to spearfish. So I don't know.
I mean, but it's still, the proportions are still believable. Like, he's well, he doesn't.
Yeah.
It's not 90s. It's still the 40s. Oh,
no,
so.
It is nowhere close to 90s.
But I do like a muscular dude running around without his shirt as a big sell point for the comic. But anyways, that was a long detour. What else have we got? Can't just have Johnny Canuck taking up our airwaves.
All right, how about a book with America in the title then?
Whoa.
I read 4 issues, The Last Sons of America from Boom. And these ran at 2015 into 2016, collected in a trade in 2017. And it is written by a pal of mine, Philip Kennedy Johnson, and drawn by
pal of a few different pals of mine, Matthew Dow Smith, who's an I know him, he's a little more than an acquaintance. And it's funny because the intro to the trade is written by another good friend of mine, Ron Mars. So I was like, oh, I got to read this book, right? So it is set in a near future where, like, a biological weapon, I believe, of some kind was set off in the USA that made everyone sterile. And so now the US is an even bigger market for adopting kids. And kids are, you know, worth their weight in gold or more, twice that. And there's a pair of brothers that are like adoption collection agents. Their MO is to like look to buy kids from desperate families that are in need in Mexico that might be willing to give up one of their kids. They're not really bad guys. I mean, they're tempted, but they also realize it would be the lowest straw, the worst thing to do, to like do like snatch and grab, like kidnapping type stuff, which apparently other people do, but they don't. And then there's good characterization between these two. They're two brothers, they're twins. One is slightly disfigured. He's diminutive with a missing like a forearm. And it's because they were a couple of the last kids that were born after the event that made everyone sterile. So they were a high rate of birth defects seen at that time with that population. So anyway, they meet a stray girl and they position to move her out of the country, but it turns out to be like a mob boss's daughter who was on the run. And she also knows a secret about him and his operations that would kind of blow the lid off of what the whole country of Mexico is up to during this time and with the kids and all that sort of stuff that they're hawking to the U.S. And it makes helping her get out not just be a matter of doing their job, but also like a moral matter of justice. And so everyone's coming after them because the kingpin guy totally owns the town and everybody in it. It's a fun read, even despite the grim circumstances of the world that the tale is set in. It's like a page-turning thriller. And reads really well in a trade, too.
Sounds like fun. Oh, what? You said this was 4 issues?
Yep.
And is it, like, done, or, like, open-ended?
Maybe no, it's done. Done, although the world is rich enough that he could certainly tell other stories in this world, but he's gone on to other things, and at the time, it seemed like he was writing full of a lot of different ideas and just kind of getting them out there.
Hey, got to land that Netflix show.
As we make it a lot of shows.
As we discussed previously, it doesn't even have to really match the comic book at all.
This one has a small enough cast and a realistic enough setting and scenes that you really could.
All right, is this a good place to wrap this one up, gentlemen?
No, I got another book.
Oh, give it to us, Steve.
I got to, because I got to get it off my chest, because I've really, really enjoyed like rereading and then finishing it off. I never read the end of Hellboy in Hell.
Yeah.
Mignola's last written and drawn Hellboy book.
Well, that took a long time to come out.
Yeah, well, at the end it did. And then, you know, I'm one of those guys who buys monthly but reads like it's a trade a lot of the time. I wait till the story is one issue from being done and then, like, read everything. So then when the next issue comes, it's still fresh in my head and I get the conclusion. But Volume 1, the trade paperback that reprinted the first 5 issues of Hellboy in Hell, came out 2014. And Volume 2, which reprinted issues 6 through 10, came out in 2016. And it's so good to get into Hellboy's world, and was so fun, especially like at this time when the whole world seems to be slowing down for good or ill. Like, a slowed down world is perfect for Hellboy, it seems. You know, it's like the old stopwatch test of Kevin's. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of dialogue or text in these issues at all, but you don't blow through them because the, you know, the mood creating art and his stylized version of drawing things just makes you have to slow down to, I guess, first decode what you're seeing and just sort of accept the world and then, you know, wander around a little bit in it and just sort of be in that space that he creates. His stories aren't, you know, really intense with any big, interesting, clever conclusion that of something that was set up earlier in the story that then pays off later. It basically, Hellboy goes into situation after situation and experiences some creepy folklore-y type mood type dynamic going on, and in the very end punches somebody and it ends. You know, that's Hellboy in a nutshell. But here he's died. Mignola killed his signature character, needed a change after his time with the BPRD and all the solo tales and the movies and stuff. And then he sent Hellboy around the world a little bit. He went to like Mexico, and then ultimately he fought a dragon. He lost an eye like Odin, and then he died at the end of it. And now he is in hell. So you've got him like, you know, falling into a big pit, and he comes across Edmund Gray, who was Mignola's, like a cult detective that worked for Queen Victoria in other stories. And you get to learn what his ultimate fate was and how he ends up here in hell. But Edward Gray is like Hellboy's guide, protector for a while as they go into Pandemonium, which is the big central city in hell. All the lords of hell and their armies have all fled and gone into hiding because of Hellboy coming. So it's this tour of evacuated, desolate, barely populated hell, which just lends to those nice, big, lonely landscapes and environments, you know, that Mignola renders so well. And then there's this whole thing of like, almost like a Dickens Ghost of Christmas Past, Present, and Future. He gets three visitations and has to go through all of these experiences, just like you would expect Hellboy to have to do. And the whole tour of hell thing, like, I really loved Dante's Inferno as a kid. That was one of the things that the pieces of like real literature that I poured through, read more than once, really thought it was, you know, almost like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where there were all these references to other literary things that like you should know about if you were really well read, and you end up looking different things up and learning about them and stuff, which is kind of cool. There were all these little skeleton key Easter egg type things that referred to other characters and literature. And that's the way Dante's Inferno was, because when he came across all different characters in hell, plus there was the whole map thing. And Kevin, you and I love our maps and cutaways and stuff, and having a map of hell with the different rings and the different punishments fitting the crime was really cool. And I mean, I know I'm on a roll here, but I loved the X-Men annual that was Nightcrawler's Inferno, where they did their riff on the whole Dante thing with Doctor Strange and the X-Men. Really good stuff. So it really tickled my fancy to kind of be wandering through hell with such a great wandering character like Hellboy.
And so this the whole team up with Godzilla.
There's the whole right, Godzilla just went through this trip too, and I love that stuff for kind of the same reason. But this is Mignola doing his character. So many times he's written Hellboy stuff and had other people draw him, but here he is like returning, doing the whole thing, and he's still totally got it. These pages are also available in an artist edition that I have that is wonderful to look through too. But there's the whole thing of Hellboy's prophecy that they get back into, and the whole purpose of that right hand of doom, and you learn how he was bonded with it originally and why and what its purpose is and what it does. And Hellboy learns of his birth, his father, the fate of his father, why he was teleported to Earth. It really is ties up all the loose ends of Hellboy and is a great send-off for the character. It even wanders for a few issues and just lets Hellboy get into a few different side tales, which I guess was Mignola's original idea for this to just be an ongoing. And then he had the idea of Hellboy killing Satan and then Hell really being thrown into chaos and decided, you know what, this is actually going to be the end of the series, and decided to wrap it up several issues later with issue 10. But to have it in two trades, I don't know if it's also available in one hardcover volume somewhere, but also in that oversized artist edition. This is really good Hellboy.
Yeah, they have the library edition thing that they do.
Right, right.
I'm not a regular Hellboy reader, but what I liked in the old days is you could just grab a random trend and read it, and it read just like there wasn't, I mean, I'm sure there was continuity, but for a casual reader, you could just pop open a book and there you go, you know, like it was a fun story. Like you say, you just find some magical thing, wanders around, beats it up, calls it a day.
This also had that, like, and again with the Marvel references, but we're Marvel guys, is that whole, it has that old man Logan vibe too, like on that one last adventure that he's kind of beaten down, he's been blinded in one eye, there's a few issues where he's kind of sickly because these demons are picking at his soul for a particular reason that gets all resolved. And just like reading those Marvel The End stories, when you know it's a The End story, and so that specter is looming throughout the whole journey as you're kind of walking along with Hellboy here, it's charming in a way. I really enjoyed stepping back into this world.
Oh yeah. Well, or like the old Marvel What Ifs, which were always
oh
grim.
Yep. Ending. Yeah. They didn't end well most of the time. All right, now you can end the episode, Andrew. I'm clean. I've said all my sins.
Well, I want to
confess.
Want to make sure we keep you happy, Steve. We got to keep luring you back in, you know. But, yeah, it's indie comic book noise, people. Kevin, you got your catchphrase ready?
Keep reading them indie comic books. No, keep reading more indie comics. Isn't that something like what it's supposed to be?
I don't. I've long since tuned out of that.
Stay safe. Podcast. We were socially distant friends long before it came in vogue.
My name is Johnny. Johnny Canuck. I've been through a lot in 40 years, and some years are tougher than others. One year, I tried to outrun a ranger for 7 days, but in the end, I failed. And many years before that, I faced off against an islander and surrendered. Some years, you feel like you got nothing to live for. But not this year. This year, I've blackened hawks. I've preyed on predators and endangered sharks. And now it's time to ruin the Bruin.